All right, welcome back everybody to the deep dive. We've got a kind of unique situation for you today. Two separate cases, two separate Ray Joneses.
Separate times, separate crimes.
That's right, but both opinions from the Louisiana Supreme Court.
Yep, and we're going to make a deep dive into both of them.
And as always, our mission here is to really unlock the core legal principles from these cases, so you can understand them quickly and efficiently. And today, what we're going to see is how the name might be the same, but the legal issues are vastly different. We're going to be looking at everything from the rules of evidence to the world of sentencing and plea bargains.
Exactly. These cases really offer a fascinating glimpse into two really crucial aspects of criminal procedure. And by the end of this deep dive, you'll have a much clearer understanding of these vital areas of the law. So shall we jump right in?
Let's get into it. So case number one, State v. Ray Jones from 1980. This case deals with a pretty heavy topic, a murder conviction.
Yeah, definitely a serious case.
Yeah. So this Ray Jones, he was found guilty of murdering his infant son. The mother's testimony, it paints a picture of a pretty brutal attack. Bruises on the baby's body were discovered in the backyard, and Jones was under the influence of drugs at the time. Now, what makes this case particularly interesting for our deep dive is that Jones made some incriminating statements while he was at the hospital and later at the police station. And as you might guess, those statements became a central point of contention in his appeal.
That's right. His lawyers argued that those statements shouldn't have been allowed as evidence at all.
And they also had issues with how the cross-examination of a key witness was handled during the trial. They felt like their client's rights were restricted there. So we've got two big issues to unpack here.
Absolutely. Two really critical points that we'll delve into.
Okay, so let's start with those incriminating statements. What exactly was the defense's argument about why those statements shouldn't have been admissible in the first place?
Well, as you might expect, they went straight to the big one, the Miranda rights. You know, the right to remain silent, the right to an attorney. They argued that because Jones wasn't properly advised of his Miranda rights, any statements he made should have been thrown out.
So they were saying the police messed up and that tainted anything Jones said afterwards.
That's basically it. But things get a bit nuanced here because the Louisiana Supreme Court actually rejected that argument.
They did. So they allowed the statements to be used against Jones, even though the defense was raising Miranda concerns.
Right. And their reasoning is really important for understanding how Miranda works in practice. So there were a couple of different sets of statements we're talking about here. First, there were some things Jones said to a psychiatrist at the hospital. The court found those statements to be voluntary and, crucially, not the result of any police questioning. You know, Miranda is mainly about protecting people from being pressured into confessing by the police.
So if the police aren't the ones asking the questions, even if you're in a hospital, Miranda might not apply.
Exactly. It's not just about the location, it's about who's doing the questioning and whether they're acting on behalf of law enforcement.
Okay, that makes sense. So what about those other things Jones was saying while he was at the hospital, the things he said that weren't directly to the psychiatrist?
Right. The court looked at those too. And what they found significant was that those remarks were spontaneous and coherent, meaning they weren't, rambling or delirious. This suggested to the court that he was in a state of mind where he could make rational choices and wasn't being coerced by anyone.
So even though he was in a hospital, potentially under the influence of drugs, the court believed he was capable of speaking freely.
Yeah, and that's important because it undermines the idea that he was in a vulnerable position where his rights needed extra protection.
Okay. So then we have the confession that happened later at the police station. Now, I remember there being a bit of a wrinkle there because one of the officers made a comment, right?
Right. So even though Jones was definitely in custody at that point, the court still found that his confession was spontaneous. And this is where things get really subtle. The officer's comment, they determined, wasn't actually an interrogation tactic. It was more of an observation that triggered a reaction from Jones.
So even though the officer said something, the court didn't see it as a deliberate attempt to get a confession.
Right. And there's also evidence that Jones had actually invoked his right to counsel earlier, but then changed his mind and decided to talk anyway. So the sequence of events and Jones's own actions played a big role in the court's decision here.
So it sounds like the court was really focused on whether or not Jones was truly acting on his own free will when he confessed.
Absolutely. But then there's another layer to this. The court also brought up the concept of harmless error.
Okay, now for our listeners who might not be lawyers, what exactly does that mean, harmless error?
So harmless error, basically means that even if there was a mistake made during the trial, like maybe a piece of evidence was admitted that shouldn't have been, it doesn't automatically mean the whole trial was unfair. If the rest of the evidence is super strong, the court might decide that the error didn't actually affect the outcome.
So even if the police messed up with the Miranda warning, the other evidence against Jones was strong enough that the court didn't think it would have changed the jury's decision.
Exactly. They looked at the big picture, the totality of the evidence, and decided that even without the confession, the outcome would likely have been the same.
Interesting. Okay, so that covers the admissibility of the statements. What about the second issue, the limits on cross-examination? I think it had something to do with the mother's drug use, right?
Right. During the trial, the judge put some restrictions on the defense's ability to ask questions about the mother's alleged drug use, and the Supreme Court ultimately upheld that decision.
They did. So they agreed that it was okay to limit those questions.
They did. And their reasoning was pretty straightforward. They basically said that the mother's drug use, even if true, wasn't relevant to whether or not Ray Jones killed his son.
So it was considered a distraction from the main issue.
Exactly. And judges have the power to prevent lawyers from going off on tangents that aren't directly related to the case. They didn't see this line of questioning as helping the jury reach a fair verdict.
So to kind of wrap up this first Ray Jones case, what are the big takeaways for our listeners?
Well, first and foremost, it's a good reminder that Miranda warnings aren't always required. It's not just about being in custody. It's about being questioned by the police in a way that could lead to self-incrimination.
So voluntary statements, even if made while in custody, might still be fair game in court.
Right. And secondly, the case illustrates the harmless error rule.
Mm-hmm.
It shows how appellate courts look at the overall picture to decide if a procedural misstep really affected the fairness of the trial.
Okay. So with that, let's shift gears completely. We've got a second Ray Jones case to unpack, and this one involves a marijuana sentencing appeal.
A stark contrast to the first case, for sure.
Definitely. So in this one, our Ray Jones was involved in selling marijuana. Small amounts, only $12 worth, and only on two occasions.
And to further reduce the severity, he agreed to a plea bargain, where the original charge was lessened to attempted distribution.
He pleaded guilty, and that's where things take a turn.
Because despite the plea, the relatively minor nature of the crime, and the lack of any previous criminal record, the judge decided to hand down the maximum sentence, 5 years in prison plus a $7,000 fine.
Which, you know, for selling $12 worth of marijuana twice seems, it seems pretty excessive, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a striking sentence. And the Louisiana Supreme Court thought so, too.
They did.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, they vacated that sentence not just once, but twice.
Twice. Wow. Okay, so what was their reasoning for sending this case back to the lower court over and over?
Well, the main reason was that the trial court simply didn't give good enough reasons for imposing such a harsh penalty. Louisiana law, specifically Article 894.1, requires judges to clearly explain why they're choosing a particular sentence. They had to show that they've considered the individual circumstances of the defendant and the specifics of the crime.
Individualized sentencing, it's not a one-size-fits-all situation.
Exactly. And the Supreme Court found that the trial judge's reasoning was just insufficient.
So they send it back, and what happens? The judge does it again.
Pretty much. The second time around, the judge doubled down, citing Jones's perceived likelihood to reoffend as the main reason for the max sentence. But again, the Supreme Court wasn't satisfied.
So what was the final legal basis for striking down this maximum sentence?
It all goes back to that principle of individualized sentencing we were talking about. Supreme Court was basically saying, look, maximum sentences should be reserved for truly egregious cases. For someone with no prior record selling such a tiny amount of marijuana, it's simply not justifiable to throw the book at them.
It's about proportionality, right? The punishment should fit the crime.
Exactly. And in this case, the Supreme Court felt that the punishment was far too severe for the offense.
And then, of course, there was the whole issue with the plea agreement. Jones claimed that the prosecution had promised him no jail time.
Right. This is a huge point. Plea bargains are essentially contracts. Both sides have to stick to the deal. And the Supreme Court was very clear on this, saying that if a prosecutor makes a promise during plea negotiations and then breaks that promise, well, that undermines the whole process.
So the defendant might be able to withdraw their guilty plea and go back to fighting the charges.
Exactly. And that's crucial for maintaining the integrity of the system. People plead guilty based on trust, and that trust has to be honored.
Okay, so big picture. What should our listeners take away from this marijuana sentencing case?
I think the key takeaway is that maximum sentences require rock-solid justification. Judges can't just hand them out without a really compelling reason based on the facts of the case and the offender's history.
And maybe even more importantly, this case highlights the absolute importance of honoring plea agreements.
Couldn't agree more. Those agreements aren't just formalities. They carry a lot of legal weight and impact the lives of real people.
So, stepping back and looking at these two Ray Jones cases together, it's remarkable how they illustrate such different aspects of criminal law.
It really is. On one hand, we have the complex world of evidence admissibility, especially when it comes to confessions and Miranda rights.
And on the other hand, we see the principles of fair sentencing and the critical importance of upholding plea agreements.
And yet, despite these differences, there's a common thread running through both cases.
Which is?
The emphasis on due process and procedural fairness. In both cases, the Supreme Court was very careful to make sure that the legal process was followed correctly and that everyone involved was treated justly.
Whether it's scrutinizing how a confession was obtained or making sure a sentence is properly justified, the courts play a huge role in safeguarding our rights.
Absolutely. And for anyone listening who's interested in the law, these cases really drive home how crucial those procedural safeguards are.
So just to recap some of the key points we covered today, we learned that voluntary statements can be admissible in court even without Miranda warnings, and we saw how the harmless error rule works in practice.
We also delved into the requirements for individualized sentencing and the serious consequences that can arise when plea agreements are broken.
A lot of legal ground covered, but hopefully it's given everyone a better understanding of these crucial areas of the law.
I think so. And perhaps more broadly, these cases raise some interesting questions about justice and fairness in our legal system. You know, how do we balance the need for public safety for the protection of individual rights? How do we ensure that everyone, regardless of the crime they're accused of, gets a fair shake in court?
Those are really important questions that go beyond just these specific cases.
Definitely food for thought for everyone listening.